Welcome back to episode 144 of Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And in today's conversation, I'm joined by Dr. Eric Daimler, and we're talking about the future of artificial intelligence. Eric is an authority in artificial intelligence with over 20 years of experience in the field as an entrepreneur, an executive, an investor, technologist, and policy advisor. There's very few people who are better placed than Eric to have this discussion. Eric served under the Obama administration as Presidential Innovation Fellow for AI and Robotics in the Executive Office of the President, and as that sole authority, he was driving forward the agenda for the US leadership in research, commercialization, and even the public adoption of AI and robotics. During this episode, expect to get an understanding on a basic level what AI is, how it's implemented in society, and which sectors it is likely to be the most prominent. I ask about healthcare, transport, and even about data and social media. Importantly, this leads to ethical discussions about what AI can and should do, what boundaries we should draw, and what frameworks need to be put in place. As part of this, we delve into the impact of AI on the job market, which is a common criticism of machines and robots taking the jobs of humans. Eric shares his vision of AI in our lives and how he hopes people like you and I can engage with this conversation and about how it will impact society and our lives. Given we're talking about technology, today's podcast is sponsored by Crypto Glasgow. Founders Dawn and Deck have appeared three times now on the podcast talking about all things cryptocurrency and understanding a little bit more about what's going on within that market. The crypto space is vast and it's growing, and much like AI, it's very easy to get lost in the noise and the misinformation that's out there. Investing in crypto does differ a little bit to other assets, and the Crypto Glasgow team have you covered with over 20 years combined investing experience in all asset classes. You can rely on their specific crypto expertise to navigate what can be a pretty confusing market. No matter whether you've got an investment approach like me and you're looking to invest for the longer term and dollar cost average and pick coins and use cases that you really agree with, or you're somebody that has a risk appetite and wants to trade and try and make quick profits, Crypto Glasgow have got you covered with a range of different services. I'm a member of CG Pro, which is the Discord for just $29.99 a month. It combines everything you need from investing, trading, and education to go from being a beginner in crypto to a pro. There are also other options where you can get their startup guide or their level up guide, or you can have a one-on-one consultation with one of the team. To get involved with the Crypto Glasgow lot, you need to dive across to www.ccgla.co.uk, and that'll be linked in the show notes. Given we're talking about technology and AI, I'm actually pleased to announce a new sponsor for the podcast as well, and that is FitLogic Systems. Owner Joe McNee has worked in the fitness space for a number of years now while juggling a full-time job and three kids and a young family. He started automating boring, repetitive tasks when it came to working as a fitness coach, and over time, this grew from a part-time hobby into a business, and he's worked with some of the big names across the fitness industry now. FitLogic Systems can fully implement a custom automation solution to your business that allows you as a coach to do more coaching and more client work and less admin work. This can work whether you're a one-man band looking to get back more of your time, a coach looking to reduce their admin load, or you're trying to scale your business to the next level and increase your capacity with more coaches and more clients. Many of you will know regular podcast guest David Hatt of MTN Coaching. He has used FitLogic Systems over the past couple of years to ensure he keeps the quality of his coaching high without getting too bogged down in the boring admin work. If you're not sure if this is right for you as a fitness coach to scale your business, you can take the quiz below in the show notes and it will be linked in there as readinesstoscale.scoreapp.com, or you can find Joe on Instagram at joe_fitlogic_systems. Again, that'll be linked in the show notes. Before we dive into this episode, I want to say a huge thank you for your continued support, and again, a bit of a new topic for us to cover on this podcast. I'm excited to hear what you all think. Let's get into this one right now. Hello, welcome back to Cambro Conversations. In today's conversation, we're diving into a huge topic of artificial intelligence. To do so, I'm joined by Dr. Eric Daimler. Eric, thanks for joining me.
Good afternoon, good morning, good day. Yeah, wherever everybody is, yeah.
Yes, we've got the timelines, or time zones, sorry, all lined up for this one. And it's certainly one that I've been excited when I saw this coming up in my calendar. Because Eric, you've got such a breadth of experience. When we look at your CV, entrepreneur, investor, technologist, even policymaker as well, I think it puts you in a little bit of a unique position when it comes to talking about artificial intelligence as a broad topic, because you've come at it from so many different angles, I guess, across your career.
Well, you could say it's diverse. You could also say it's concentrated, because I have spent my life in and around AI in various capacities, from a researcher to a venture capitalist on Sand Hill Road, to an entrepreneur many times, to working in the government in the Obama administration. So in one way, it's actually very narrow, but right, it's a breadth of experience about that I think is literally unique, but certainly rare.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a very fair point. It's narrow but deep on a particular subject area, albeit across different ways to work within that sector, I suppose.
Yeah.
For those that don't know your background then, Eric, obviously I've listed off some headlines there. Can you share a bit of an overview of who Eric is to the world?
Well, if people know me, if they know me at all, they'll often know me from the time that I spent during the last year of the Obama administration as the AI authority, kind of colloquially known as the science advisor to the president, is the group that holds people like me. So inside there, there were people, experts on space. There was another fantastic gentleman who was an expert on cybersecurity. So even though my PhD is in computer science, you know, I'm not an expert in cybersecurity. I know a few things, but it's not really my focus. So we had an expert in that. We had also experts in healthcare and other areas around, even as far as soil conservation. So these were science advisors, non-political, operates within the White House, but a non-political group that I had the privilege of working with for the last year of that administration, 2016. I had previously spent, as we talked about, many decades around AI. I started as a researcher at Stanford University, University of Washington, Seattle, up where Microsoft is, and at Carnegie Mellon University in Pennsylvania, where I ended up getting my PhD and serving on their faculty in the School of Computer Science. And I've also worked as a venture capitalist on Sand Hill Road professionally as part of a fund. Concomitant with that, starting a couple companies with various rates of success. And so now I sit on a few boards. One is SoftBank's largest investment in AI. And I run my own AI firm that was a spin out of MIT that we can talk about, that I think charts a future for you know, foundational developments in AI.
Absolutely, Eric. And in terms of AI, it seems like quite a modern term, but you're explaining there you've got decades of experience within it. What were kind of the world's first experiences of AI, if we were to go back to the early parts of your career where it was maybe a newer concept than it is now, albeit many of the listeners would maybe think AI is quite a recent phenomenon?
Yeah, it's a funny conversation to have. To go way back, really the start of it, the year was 1956, if I recall that correctly, where a group of very smart individuals got together in the Northeast United States to develop what they thought at the time was going to be a summer project. And they came up with this term that they meant to be a little controversial. So they got a couple things right and a couple things wrong. The foundations of that research continue. The definition or the meaning of the word has morphed a little bit. It has gone through some ups and downs, but really entered the consciousness of the general public and our general discourse around the time that I entered service. It was probably a motivator for the match between my being in the government, as I was the first person in that role. But now there is a terrifically talented team of people inside of an AI office in the White House. I think it's called the AI Office Initiative or something like that.
They needed the team to replace one man.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. I'd like to say, yeah, five people are now doing my work. But, you know, I think it's now recognized that it's a big job, and it's going to be a foundation, not only for the United States, but the allies of the United States and of Western civilization for the rest of our lifetimes. So it warranted a bigger a bigger dedication of resources. So it's been around for a long time. I'll give you a story about that a little bit. You can do a little thought experiment. So as you're listening to this, you can just think this question: when do you think the first autonomous car hit the road? So, we know Tesla is the one that's in the news all the time about pushing this idea of autonomous cars. We could get a little more precise with our language and call it driver assistance, but I'll just ask in a general way. You can think in your head, when do you think the first time was that a car went on a public road with no driver assistance and was able to just do the things that cars do, keep in its lane, stop at a stop sign, what have you. Teslas came out, roughly a decade ago or so. We can call those some version of autonomous cars, at least, the S, not the Roadster. So when do we think? I won't put you on the spot, but you can throw out a number if you'd like.
Yeah, but the number in my head, if Tesla is a decade ago, then maybe they'd iterated on it for 10 years before that. So maybe something in the late 90s.
Okay. That's a reasonable guess. So often what people think, and this is another reasonable guess, is you'd say in the end of the early 2000s, mid 2000s, there was a competition sponsored by the U.S. Defense Department to take autonomous cars off-road. It was a DARPA Grand Challenge, and it morphed then into a city competition, not on public streets in that case, but a closed loop where autonomous cars were crashing into things that they weren't intended to go around an obstacle course. So around what I think it was like 2005 or so, Carnegie Mellon and then later Stanford had entries to drive out in the desert, and those were Hummers at the time, and then people got a little more comfortable at even doing it with a Volkswagen SUV to drive autonomous cars by themselves in the desert. That was sort of uncontrolled. But we can really go back even further than that. The date is 1983.
Okay.
Now, it was a big van. It had, as people said at the time, more computing power in the back than the whole developing world. And it went very slow, only about 5, 6, 7 kilometers per hour. But it did the job. You had a van driving down the street, stopping at stop signs in 1983. Now, Mercedes had one that would go down a freeway, but it had to be perfect weather. It had to have really bright lines, and it was only on a freeway. So those are the dates where it really got started. And I bring this up because the modern discourse, suggests that, to have Elon Musk tell it, full autonomous driving is right around the corner. It's coming next year. And we might get misled to say, some sort of AI magic is also going to come very, very soon. But it's been in process for a long time. This stuff is really hard. There are many obstacles that appear as we progress in one area. Other obstacles then emerge as something we need to knock down. So it's been going on for a while. And I've been fortunate to be playing a role at the forefront
in many regards, because by 2016, when you're serving within the administration, you'll have seen quite a lot. But also, if we consider that 1983 is when we had our first car driving around without a driver, so to speak, it's been a lot of work in the process up until that point as well. Whereas I guess, like you say, my initial reaction when you hear the term AI, you think very modern developments, very recent developments.
Some parts are modern. The current trendy AI is the term deep learning. So that's a type of artificial intelligence that people seem to have at least heard about. That's relatively recent, but other developments that take in the sensors around the world and aggregate them into something that is actionable, that's been going on in iterations and slow little steps of development for a couple of decades.
In layman's terms then, Eric, what does it mean to have an AI system?
You know, I got this question asked a couple of times a week by members of Congress when I was working in Washington, D.C. And the answer I came up with is one that I hope will be useful to your listeners as they just go about their lives interacting. It's not the strict technical definition, but it's a way that I find to be useful. And it goes like this, that we have data in the world, and that comes in through sensors. So the sensors could have been the LIDAR on top of my autonomous car, or it could be a sensor that I have in my house that detects air quality. So that's taking in data. That data then goes through whatever it goes through to through a network or any other setup you may have to then plan. So you have a sensing, and then you have a planning. So AI is a system. And then that planning, you have what we might call traditional ways we think about artificial intelligence. And that planning says, okay, I took in the data from the world. For our autonomous car example, I see some objects ahead. I'm now at this stage going to decide whether or not, or make a choice about whether or not that is a shadow over a crosswalk or a person over a crosswalk. So that's a planning stage, sensing and then planning. And then we have a third stage, and the third stage is I got to act on that. So based on the confidence level, this is probabilistic, based on the confidence level, am I going to slow down for that shadow? Or am I going to stop because I actually think it's a person? Or am I going to just let the driver intervene and I'm going to hand it off to them, me, the machine, this thing talking. So slow, stop, driver intervention, or do nothing. But it's sense, plan, act. And then I learn from the experience. So every time I pass that crosswalk, the light is slightly different. The images coming across are slightly different. The probability of there being a person or a tumbleweed is slightly different. So I'm going to learn from that experience. And that's what it means to learn. You know, AI is not going to spontaneously learn Mandarin Chinese. You know, it's not going to suddenly recite poetry. It's going to learn about that intersection, that part where it thinks there is a crosswalk and maybe a shadow. So it's going to sense, plan, act, and then learn from the experience. Sense, plan, act, learn from the experience. That's a system that is AI. Then I think that definition serves the 99% of us that are not day-to-day AI researchers. You know, if you wanted to be pedantic, you would say that that deep learning that we talked about is it's itself a subset of machine learning, which was in the common discourse not so long ago. Deep learning is a subset of machine learning. Machine learning itself is a subset of artificial intelligence. That's a probabilistic arm of artificial intelligence. And then there are deterministic arms of artificial intelligence. Therefore, there are non-machine learning AIs. That's the strictly true way of talking about it. But that's like just not going to serve us in our day-to-day experience.
I like your definition, Eric. And I like how practical it is. And the notes that I scribbled down were very linked to the terms that you use. So things like stimulus is what they're getting in, consideration and assessing the different options, the response and the action, and then the reviewing and the refining through the learning process to decide what to do in future. And that's very similar to humans in terms of how we respond as well, although sometimes we don't do some of these steps as well as the AI might do, because its software and its technology is a little bit more less susceptible to emotion or mistakes than maybe we are.
I think a lot of people are making this more complicated than it needs to be. You know, the underlying science can be admittedly daunting. And developing these technologies can be difficult. They take real work. They involve real dedication. But as an abstraction for us as citizens to be thinking about it so that we can change or frame policies as we want this technology to be in our lives, I think this is a definition that works for people.
Yeah, very, very, very helpful. And I think when I say layman's terms, that sometimes does people who listen to a self-development podcast and try and better themselves a disservice, because we have inquisitive minds that want to take information on board. But the way you've delivered that, Eric, is perfect and gives us a foundation to go further into such a big topic. For me, Eric, I'd be curious to know, what sector do you see AI potentially having the biggest impact? What sector do you have like the greatest hopes for?
You know, it's going to really change everything, but it really changes everything in a particular order. And we can't really know. It's really very difficult to foresee the timing of these changes. What's different, because I'm often asked, you know, what's different, what's changed about this particular disruption relative to other disruptions, is that it's digital. So the change, when it happens, is abrupt. You know, we don't have much warning. We just know that it will come. If you want to look about where AI will come in over the next couple of years, you look at generally that concept of sense, plan, act, and then learn from the experience. And then you can use a framework for the way of thinking about AI, maybe in two ways. One is that it's an augmentation, and another is it's just automation. You know, sometimes people say it's just statistics. That's true, but that's not really helpful for me on a Friday afternoon about what to do next. But if I think of it as automation, I can begin to think of what in my world I want to be automated. You know, we're sometimes threatened by this. The often quoted concern is around long-haul truck drivers having their jobs replaced, and that's true. But we're less conscious about other parts of our world that we have wanted to be automated. The easy example is the calculators that are on our phones that used to be independent devices on our desks. That's a type of automation. And none of us are really threatened about our being or our self-worth because the calculator can do long division faster than us, right? You know, we use Excel. That's a type of automation that replaced jobs, the people that used to do that sort of stuff manually, but we're less threatened by that. So that's an automation. That's a good way of us thinking about these technologies, is what are we going to automate? Now, if we blow that out to an industry, we can say, well, what I might like to automate is issues in the supply chain. I want to have data interact between shippers and receivers, or more to the point, between a ship and a port, or even more granular, between the people that are bringing the boxcars on the trains to the staging area in the port. Right? That's the type of specificity you need to get into when you think about then how do I need to be implementing an automated system. Then this obviously becomes widely applicable because I can do this exercise in a number of different places. The easiest places are those that have low consequence contexts. So this is why you see it in digital advertising. The ads served to us by any number of your favorite social media venues. So TikTok is a big example of being effective in manipulating our behavior. That's an expression of AI. You might say the consequence is pretty high. The consequence of failure is pretty high because it manipulates our behavior, for goodness sake. But it's not the same as having a jet airplane fall out of the sky, which uses autonomous techniques and autonomous large autonomous systems to prove the efficacy of the airplane. So that's how to think about the applicability of AI and where it's going to be making an impact next.
One of the big considerations then is how much potential downside could there be if something goes wrong with the technology then? Because you're saying there, for example, if it's managing the plane going through the sky and the technology fails, then people will probably feel more uneasy than if it's managing the algorithm we see on social media, and that's definitely a point we'll get to, and it's causing potential downsides, then it's not as serious as if a plane falls out the sky. So we're more willing to accept its integration into certain areas of our life than we are into others.
You know, this is really why I spend my time in conversations like this, is that I want people to understand AI enough to have a conversation around with themselves, with society, about how these technologies need to be applied. You know, it's not for people like me to make these decisions in a vacuum about what we want to do with these technologies. People like me will work to do our best but we have our own objectives just based on our own annual goals for the development of our projects. But absent feedback about from society about what they want, we're just going to keep developing this tech. So the example is I can have that automated system in the car just make a decision. I can say, if it's 70% confident that it's not a person, just keep on going. That may be a decision that I would come to. But society will ultimately have to make this decision. How confident do we want? Do we want zero error? I mean, that happens in some areas. I mean, that happens sometimes in drug development, but then the result is you slow drug development. So you might say, well, I want it, if there's any chance of a person getting hit, I want that car to stop. And that'd be a fair decision. But that's a conversation I really want people to make, society to make. I don't want us engineers. You know, there's 30 million of us around the world. Even the wisdom of crowds and all that, you know, I don't want us to be making the decision. I want society to be making that decision. Because these contexts vary. They matter. And we need there's things we can do about it, but that's what we need to be talking about.
Yeah, there's lots going off in my head just now, Eric. I'm going to put a pin in the job market and a pin in the social media implement. But one of the areas that you brought up there was drug design. And I know that healthcare is probably one of the sectors where a lot of people are quite passionate about automation and AI coming in, because we can do things perhaps more precisely and better. So one of those might be administration or telemedicine, drug discovery, even like robot-assisted surgery is one of the areas that I've seen like people quite excited about. Is healthcare a particular area that you've looked at when it's come to AI?
There are seemingly infinite expressions of AI for good inside of healthcare. The healthcare system in the U.S. is famously broken, but globally it could use a lot of help. I can give you one example. I was just talking to a friend about it yesterday, which is the repurposing of generic drugs. So drugs go off patent, which means that other people then can use them without any sort of royalty, and then manufacture them. The price then drops dramatically. But the combinations of these off patent drugs could solve a lot of different diseases that currently are not addressed. There is a potential that's demonstrated by a group of researchers in Miami that it's for machine learning, particularly, to be applied to the characteristics of this generic group of off-patent drugs, and have them be recombined, explore the recombination of these drugs for the application to all these other diseases. That can potentially happen in a way that is just benefits society and is not motivated by the finances of large pharma. So that's just a simple yet hugely impactful application of a little subdivision of AI.
And it's AI's ability to get through that data, have that consideration and analysis period like we were talking about when it came to the car, and then look at its options and then its actions, and then learn from its actions in terms of like combining these off-patent drugs to hopefully try and solve greater problems. I think that is quite an exciting premise and application of something that, albeit some of us will have some trepidation about, letting more into our lives, as we've discussed already with some of the examples.
Well, what you're going to do is you're going to use the AI to look at recombining these off-patent drugs. Then those drugs will go to what in the US we call phase 2 trials. So they don't have to go into phase 1 trials with these drugs already having been approved for a purpose. They're now just being approved for a recombination of a different purpose. It still has an intersection with these safety mechanisms. So this is just nothing but goodness, really, in the narrative that I just described. We should all just be super happy about that particular application of AI.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. We mentioned the job market, and that was something I wanted to come back towards. Is there a form of regulation or barriers that we can put in place that might protect jobs at a quicker rate? Because I think you said the big thing about AI is that the change will be abrupt. And I think that's part of the reason there's maybe a little bit of fear. So for example, if technology advances to a certain point, does my job become obsolete quickly? And I think that scares people more than gradual change or gradual process where there's almost a consolidation period where you know it's coming, so you react accordingly. Maybe you upskill and change.
You know, I'm not sure how much we want to protect a job. If we looked back, you know, before either of us were born, elevators became automated. You know, they used to not be automated. They then became automated. That automation scared people a little bit. So in order to entice people into an elevator where there no longer was an elevator operator, music was introduced. So soothing music would warm us into the entry into an elevator. That's where the term elevator music comes from. We wanted just to feel good about entering this elevator. Now, in that example, the people that operated elevators still had jobs for a while, but their children would not have jobs. They wouldn't go into that field. You know, similar thing to telephone switchboard operators. Again, you and I just see these things in movies, but that was a real job. And we wouldn't want to protect the job of telephone switchboard operator. It really was a terrible job. Nobody wants that job, just to sit all day and move plugs, move wires into different plugs. That's really horrible. You know, and so it's worth remembering, we don't automate jobs that we want to do. You know, people want to do some jobs, like you and I talking is something that I enjoy. I don't want to, it'd be weird to talk about automating our conversation. So there's some jobs that are going to remain, but other jobs we don't really care for, or parts of jobs we don't really care for. So that's really how for people may want to be planning their careers. And so I am sympathetic. This is my personal view, is I'm sympathetic to protecting the people, but not really protecting the jobs. When something's ready to be automated, I'm not sure we need to put up too much resistance unless there's other considerations such as safety, but that's all, that can easily be manipulated to mean anything people want it to mean.
Yeah, of course it can. And I think, as you said, there is a natural evolution that will take place, particularly in a capitalist society where we're trying to refine process, make things better, let people work in jobs potentially that are more fulfilling, as you've said, and taking away some of the more menial tasks that we know that machines can do every bit as well, but actually better than a lot of people as well. So I do think from a AI is going to steal all our jobs perspective, there's a lot of it's a little bit unfounded, because a lot of the jobs that are going to become obsolete are jobs that, like you say, people aren't especially passionate or motivated to do. And if the robots and the technology can come in and do it in a positive way, then that is actually a little bit of a win. Are there, like you mentioned us having this conversation, are there any particular skills that you think AI, it'll almost always be a little bit beyond it, and humans will potentially should double down in those areas to protect their future employment prospects?
You know, I'll say that maybe I'll answer the question if I can in a different way. You know, it's often said that empathy is the one human characteristic that computers will be never able to solve, or it'll be the last quality that computers will be able to solve. I will add to that, and I agree with that concept, that the job skill of the future will come in a couple of flavors. One is with the recognition that all of our jobs can be automated eventually. What we want to be doing is refining our ability to make our implicit knowledge explicit. Just take what's in our head and be able to describe it in increasingly precise ways. So the example of the car, as I'm driving down the street, I can, to some extent, describe that I want to stay in a lane. I can describe that I am looking out for potential pedestrians. It's hard for me to describe it with much more precision in a way that I could then put it into computer code, but it's helpful as I'm interacting with other teams inside of a transportation system, for me to be conscious about what parts I can describe with various levels of precision. That can help for all of us suggest when our jobs are in danger. As soon as I can start describe, I'm useful only to the extent that I can describe my job in with precision. But as soon as I can describe it with sufficient precision that a computer can do it, I better start moving further in expertise that a computer can't yet replicate. So this is going to be one of the two balancing acts that is part of the job skills for the future. The second job skill of the future that we see emerging today is the recognition, I'll say in the abstract first, and then I'll give you an example, the recognition and redeployment of patterns in different contexts. So I'll say that again, it's the recognition and redeployment of patterns in different contexts. So the example that we see today is in e-commerce, where you can create, we see this now Cambrian explosion of different consumer products, because you can now create these new consumer businesses without actually being a designer, or certainly without doing your own advertising or your own analytics or your own customer fulfillment. You take Shopify, you take Google to do your analytics, you can have Amazon do fulfillment, you outsource some design, and you can create everything from water bottles to whiskey, you know, everything from clothing to specialty sandwiches, and you have a new brand. This is a redeployment of these different little modules in your own particular expression. This is what has enabled the rise of the influencer economy, is you have many, many people that have these ways of reconfiguring existing tools, and they'll put their own little their own little color on it and go to it. And then, of course, what happens there is the market economics kind of dictate that the value add then needs to move somewhere. Because if you have, I think I was reading that there are just thousands of TikTok influencers that have a million followers. Well, then it becomes more of a commodity to have a million followers. And you'd say, well, what's the next thing? And breaking into that is now much more difficult. So what's the next thing to redeploy in a different context, these emerging tools? So those are the two ways I would encourage people to think about their careers. In addition to empathy, making implicit knowledge explicit, and then the recognition and redeployment of patterns in different contexts.
I'm soaking that in terms of how I can apply that in my own career to make sure I continue to be somebody that's valuable to an organization or to myself in a business capacity. And I find it interesting, the focus on precision of speech and clarity of thought and ability to articulate that. And then once you've been able to do that to a very good extent, you then move on to the next more complex thing that is at that point in time beyond the technology that we have in place. So I think that's something for people to mull over and think about in terms of how well can I articulate what I do, and how much of an expert am I in that particular area, and where do I need to go next in terms of skill set to ensure that I remain ahead of the curve or ahead of the technology.
Man, you got it exactly. See, this is just straightforward. It takes some work. And you have some thinking to do, but you got it exactly.
With that in mind, do you think at this moment in time that AI is going to have a net positive or a net negative impact on the job market?
You know, there is an argument to be made that for the job market, it's neutral, so that it creates as many jobs as it destroys. Now, people might come out in different sides of that, and Well, you might say, well, at the limit, it'll ultimately destroy jobs. It'll automate everything. Well, fine. But I'll make a bet that at least during our working careers, we continue to have jobs emerge. And it wasn't even 5 years ago where you probably would have looked at me a little funny if I said that there was a job called influencer on TikTok. And if we looked back 15 years, we both could agree that we wouldn't know what either of us were talking about if I even said there was a job available called app developer. Like, it wouldn't make any sense. Yeah. We would know in an abstract sense, oh yeah, there's probably going to be apps on phones eventually. But then to say there would be a career based on app developers and there'd be a billion of these apps, like, it just wouldn't make any sense. Or we wouldn't be able to contextualize it. So jobs do emerge and jobs get destroyed. You know, the new floor of the New York Stock Exchange is mostly for tourists now and a backdrop for media. You know, there's not a lot of floor traders there anymore. So jobs go away and jobs get created. So the argument, I think I
open the app on my phone to buy my stocks, and so do many people. It's a very different landscape in that regard.
That's right.
No, that is really interesting, Eric. So we put a pin in the social media side of things, and I think a lot of the listeners will have seen the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, where AI was painted in a particularly bad light in terms of how it structures the algorithm to either cause outrage or to continue to feed you the things that you want, to keep you on the app and increase your screen time, or to boost your likes on one particular post so you get that feeling of virality and to keep you going back and posting over and over again. But is there a way that we can have a framework for responsible AI when it comes to social media? Because although we mentioned that a plane dropping out of the sky because of a faulty programming or technology would be really clearly devastating and immediate, I think the buildup of social media being used incorrectly or working badly with our brains in some particular way is more of a down the line problem in terms of depression, suicide, and all these other kind of longer term potential effects of AI and social.
You know, I want to answer that question a little bit differently, because it gets back to why we're even having this conversation. And it's this, you know, when I was in working with the President Obama and the others in that administration, we saw in President Obama's famously Oval Office, he had an oval rug. And in that oval rug, there was an inscription that he put around, he had made, that went around the outside. And it was a quote that was popularly credited to Martin Luther King during the civil rights era. It said, the long arc of history bends towards justice. Long arc of history bends towards justice. And what President Obama would remind us of is that there's a part missing from, or a part that we would like to add to that phrase, which is, without our involvement, not without our involvement. You know, the long arc of history bends towards justice only if we are involved. So if we don't get involved, then nothing's going to happen. So the problem with some of the framing around AI being bad and creating this some sort of Hollywood dystopia, which it certainly has in the manipulation in media, is not just for nerds in the basement like me. It's for all of us to be talking about. You know, how do we want this AI to be implemented, and what's the nature of it? I want people to be engaged so that they can embrace what is often this life-changing AI. So we talked about drug discovery. You mentioned surgical robots. You know, in many cases, this can fulfill the utopia that we often will read about in science fiction. And the degree to which this falls on the spectrum closer to that utopia or the dystopia of that movie is going to be all up to us. We're currently in this discourse about how do we get manipulated by social media? Really much the same way that I know, at least I get manipulated by potato chips. You know, so the food companies know more about my physiology than I do. And you could say, well, Eric, just use willpower on those potato chips. Well, if I have one, my physiology says I'd like another. You know, and you could say, well, use the willpower. Well, it's fine. But in general, people eat too many of those little potato chips. That's what we have in the media. And that's what we have in other areas for manipulating AI. When it's then applied to safety critical issues, I want people to be similarly engaged so that we make the right decisions about the implementations of these complex systems.
There are elements of this conversation that are quite challenging for me, Eric, because a lot of my content, aside from episodes like this, are focused on personal responsibility and accountability and ownership and being your best self and managing the variables in your life that you can. And with social media, you have a responsibility to yourself to use it in a responsible way, in the same way that you have a responsibility to consume the number of calories that you think you should be consuming at a particular moment in time based on how many potato chips you can fit within that if it's relevant to your goals. But it is interesting, we were talking about the interaction between humans and the technology and the conversation that we're able to have to shape how it goes forward, whether that's going to be utopian or dystopian. And importantly, when we are talking about how AI is being used to shape how we feel through social media, there are individual human beings sitting behind it, directing that technology. And if we bring up Cambridge Analytica, which was using the data on Facebook to shape the 2016 Trump-Clinton election, but also the Brexit referendum before that in the UK, those were individuals utilizing the technology for their own means and aims. And people can be angry about the technology, but ultimately at that point in time, as we do going forward, humans were the ones directing the technology to act in the way that they wanted to. And of course you can bemoan, oh, the AI enabled you to find out what somebody's preferences were, so I sent them content that aligned with that or outraged them in a particular way that went, they were able to vote and we had all this fake news conversation. But as you've said, actually humans have a large role to play in terms of where that technology goes and how it's used, to whether we end up in a dystopia where we're all at each other's throats because of the stuff we're consuming in social media, or we end up in a utopia where we kind of consume what we feel like we've chosen to consume rather than been made to consume.
Well, you know, there's a lot to talk about here, and this to some extent gets into to philosophy, but I can just say, welcome to being a human being, a human adult. You know, we have to balance the degree to which we have to exercise our own good judgment and the extent to which we are influenced by the systems around us. You know, we can't pay attention to everything at all times. We rely on the rule of law. We rely on some baseline linear sequence of foundational truths upon which we have built assumptions, right? So we can exercise our own judgment in a broad range of domains. And we also want to be shaping the system in which we operate and our children operate so that we get the outcomes that we want to have a generation from now. You know, this gets to even human behavior around traffic. You know, how to, I remember in London, there was this conversation about how to get people to slow down around a traffic circle. And there was a question about whether you put bollards up or not. And it was determined that if you have bollards up, which makes it safer for the pedestrians, that cars moved more quickly through the traffic circle. So to slow them down, counterintuitively, you removed the bollards. You know, this could happen in traffic. We can think of an infinite number of traffic scenarios where this is probably true. You widen the street, people go faster because they think it's like somehow a highway on ramp. You narrow a street and people slow down. You put trees around and people slow down. You know, these are human behaviors. We want to be conscious that we are all human. And so we have our frailties, like me with snacks or sugar is another good one. And I also have free will, right? I also, or, you know, that's another debate, but, you know, I also can make choices. We'll say that about the extent to which I do or do not.
It is philosophical. It really is a philosophical question. I guess one of the questions that I had for you in preparation for this was, do you have a framework for evaluating the decisions that AI can and should make? Because you mentioned there about our free will and our ability to choose. We mentioned there about we could have a situation where we would agree like a 70% confidence in, yes, there's no pedestrian on this road, so this autonomous car can continue, or the 30% is there, so it should brake. How do you pull together like the decisions that we should allow AI to make and that we shouldn't allow it to make moving forward?
I think how I would address that is implement a couple of speed bumps. You know, we get this enormous increase in productivity from automation. we can slow that down and still get seemingly enormous benefit, you know, almost the same enormous benefit by slowing it. And you'd slow it in a couple of ways. One, put a circuit breaker. You can put circuit breakers a lot. You know, me as a geeky and nerdy engineer, I want to link automation. If automation can be linked, I want to. And to some extent, I'm always right. You know, like if I can, I should, and people benefit from that. But if I, you know, I don't want to have to in my calculator do a long division and then have to somehow write on a piece of paper and then go back to my calculator. I want my calculator just to sequence my calculations. It's a type of sequencing automation. But in the example of the car, you know, maybe we say, right now for society, we have a circuit breaker. Whenever there's any chance of a crosswalk, at least needs driver intervention. That's a type of conversation about a circuit breaker. Another one is having an audit, and not in the way that audit, that's another term that can easily be manipulated, but an audit. So maybe people like me can look at a declared intention of an algorithm, and it'd be a group of me, not just, you know, one person. And we can determine whether or not that algorithm, so determining whether or not it's a tumbleweed or a person at a crosswalk, dictates that we then have a circuit breaker. Does that algorithm do what we say? And we do this currently with credit scores. Those are these type of black boxes. That's a type of zero knowledge proof. So not to get too technical, but that's a different type of auditing. But those are two things I would do, is a circuit breaker and an audit applied to AI. I want these things to be linked generally. I want automation to be encouraged. And again, I want it to be embraced generally.
But that gives us two opportunities to slow it down, put the brakes on, assess, and decide whether we want to continue.
At every instance, you know, I'm not saying we do that once. You know, some of these things are going to be iterative as a process evolves. But I'll talk about something foundational to all of this, which is right now we are building increasingly complex systems, more and more complex systems. And those are, I don't think, going to get any simpler. I don't think any of your listeners would argue to say, hey, I think the world's going to get simpler over the next decade. You know, it's going to get more complex. And these systems, unfortunately, are becoming no less difficult to test for vulnerabilities. So that then brings up this foundational shift that we're going to have happen over the next 10 to 20 years. And this foundational shift is actually happening in math. It's happening that deep. It's not even in the algorithms of AI. It's happening below that in these discoveries being applied to software in these abstract mathematics of category theory. And so category theory is going to wipe the slate clean of much of what we know about IT foundationally as we build up technology that has a ground truth integrity to it, not found by today's models. This is the math that powers smart contracts on the blockchain. It is the math that enables us to have quantum computers. This is what piles quantum compilers that we as humans wouldn't be able to interpret. This is something different that will give us more comfort about the integrity of these complex systems over the next 10 to 20 years. And it's something that I'd encourage other people to study as they look to plan their careers over the next decades.
Yeah, definitely. We've definitely pushed in that career part where we need to consider where we want to be in future and foolproof ourselves against being made obsolete by the technology. But interestingly, as part of that subject, one of the most pressing things in my head is your work with Kinexys. You were talking about such a large amount of information there, and probably one of the biggest information technology problems that we face is data deluge, and it's just the sheer volume of what we have. What work are you and your team doing to overcome that?
Yeah, what people have gotten the memo about is that data is the new oil and all that, collect more data. So we all know that. You know, what's less known is that the number of data sources is also increasing quadratically. You know, we talked about Sense Plan Act on the sensing part. We have more of these sensors around our world. So if we have more sensors and we have more data, then the data relationships, which is where knowledge is held, is just a combinatorial explosion that is unable to be used and computed really in a traditional infrastructure such as relational databases. This is what's changing and being powered by this discovery in math and discovery in category theory. What our firm Kinexus AI does is we help bring together, we are just one of the companies, we happen to be the leading one, but we're one of the companies that is bringing together these very large sophisticated data models into universal data models that can better serve the purposes of large complex organizations. Anywhere from making public utilities more efficient for the delivery of energy to making planes safer. So we have fewer accidents on airplanes to making our telecommunications networks more secure. So all of that involves bringing together these very large databases in a way that guarantees integrity. That's what Kinexus AI does.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever lived in a period where we've been drowning in so much information. You said data sources increase, but the volume of data that each of these sources produces as well is just greater than ever before. So sifting through and identifying what is valuable for the particular decision-making or processes that we need to use that information for is harder than ever before. Like, in like a really silly example, we talked about TikTok and social media. People are creating more content than ever before. So you have so much opportunity to consume more than ever before. So like I sometimes talk about like a content palette. So choosing very selectively what I consume on Instagram and what I follow and what I listen to on my podcast and what YouTube subscriptions I have. And of course, the algorithm will feed me different things that I'm not following or subscribed to, but being very selective on my input of that. And I guess Kinexus are just doing that on a massive scale to identify what data do we need for the airplane company or what data do we need for the public utilities business to actually function at its best, and what can we disregard or at least put out of the picture for now?
You know, it gets even into the data models. So it's not just the data. So where, you know, Delta Airlines knows, you know, my height, my age, my eye color, but that's just data. Data is becoming a little cheap. What is complicated is the data models. So they know that I generally fly out of San Francisco and I will go to London or where have you. Their decision about whether or not they upgrade my class of seating or offer me a certain airfare for that flight, that's a data model. That's their decision. That's their knowledge based on particular data. Where do I generally fly and the characteristics of Eric? Those data models get infinitely more sophisticated, and those data models are what becomes very difficult to plan around. If you think about just me and the 26 million other people that fly through any of these big international airports in a year, how do you compute that? When those millions become billions and trillions, there's a phase change, a little bit like liquid to solids. I mean, it's something you need to relate to this differently. And that is what is demanding this foundational application of the discoveries from category theory.
Yeah, no, I completely understand, Eric. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see how we manage this continued data deluge or whatever term we want to use in that regard. And last question before I ask people where to connect with you, Eric, what is your vision for AI? What do you think it's going to look like in, say, 10 years time in 2032?
You know, what I really hope is that we, one of my colleagues in the White House used to say, that we have everybody on the field. The vision is that we have everybody on the field talking about, engaged in the conversation about how these life-changing technologies get applied in our day-to-day life to make all of our lives better. I think this is, regardless of geography, regardless of politics, some of these automated technologies just require, really demand that people be engaged so that we embrace these technologies. I think that people studying category theory and talking about making their implicit knowledge explicit is going to serve everybody in their careers and in their day-to-day experiences.
Yeah, and a noble vision. And like you say, everyone being involved in the conversation allows us to importantly shape whether we head towards elements of dystopia, which make us very uncomfortable, and elements of utopia, which we ultimately really, really want. And I guess my final question, Eric, alongside saying thank you very much for joining me, is where should people head towards if they want to continue the conversation and ask you more questions and understand a bit more about what you're up to?
Sure. You know, Kinexus.com is our firm. Or LinkedIn is probably a good place to follow me for any new content that or any new thoughts we have around category theory. There's a lot of great books around category theory, but that's how to connect with me. Follow on LinkedIn or Kinexus.com.
Excellent, Eric. Those will be linked in the show notes below. Thank you very much for joining me. And thank you to you, the listener, as always. I'm sure you've enjoyed this one. And I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very